This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, a fossil found in Ethiopia is letting scientists look millions of years into our evolutionary history. And according to UNICEF, cases of rape are increasing at an alarming rate in Nigeria. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A top story, a report by the International Refugee Rights Initiative, reveals a cocktail of frustration, unemployment, post-traumatic stress, alcohol abuse, and escalating quarrels among refugee communities in northern Uganda. Uganda is home to 1.3 million refugees, 833,000 of these from South Sudan, among whom the research was carried out. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Amol Dorcas has lived as a refugee in Uganda since early 2014 after running away from armed conflict in South Sudan. With Uganda's free land policy for refugees on arrival, Amol got her 7.6 meters by 9.1 meters share of land in the Nyumanzi settlement, Adjumani district. She says the land is not sufficient, however, especially for those who want to grow crops for food. Like most refugees, in order to survive, she had to enter an agreement with a member of the host community. The deal allows her to grow crops on their land on the condition that she pays some money at year end. Doka says conflict arose when a member of the host community declined to respect the agreement.
But when these crops do well, so the owner of that land actually, or an unknown person, will just come, they'll take them. So without you knowing, and you are staying in the settlement, we share the borehole with the host community. These boreholes also, they are not enough. Sometimes the women and the children can just collide at the water point and just like kind of bring in conflict.
Land wrangling between South Sudan refugees and host communities are just one of many conflicts going on in refugee settlements in Uganda. Among other challenges are recruitment of refugees as combatants, unemployment, post-traumatic stress, and alcohol abuse. This was revealed in a report released Wednesday by the International Refugee Rights Initiative, describing its finding as a cocktail of frustrations in which refugees are engulfed. Thess Van Laar, the lead researcher for the International Refugee Rights Initiative, points out that another issue of concern is the presence in refugee settlements of individuals involved in the South Sudanese conflict.
Our research has confirmed that several parties to the conflict have attempted to recruit refugees as combatants, although it does remain difficult to establish the full scope of this practice and to what extent that has continued since the signing of a peace agreement in 2018. But members of the warring parties have visited the refugee settlements, sometimes to reunite with their families that are staying there, but also at times to target political opponents.
Uganda is home to 1.3 million refugees, 833,000 of whom are from South Sudan, living in settlements in northern Uganda. In the three districts of Adjumani, Lamor and Arua, which has the largest refugee population, the number of refugees exceeds the number of Ugandan citizens. This has escalated conflict in the settlements. In order to deter some of these conflicts, the Ugandan government and the UN Refugee Agency deliberately have separated communities in some settlements to avoid incidents. Ndahiro Innocent, the government refugee integration and legal officer, reveals to VOA that the government recently got partial funding from a World Bank grant worth 336 million that will be used to resolve land wrangles between host communities and refugees. On refugee recruitment, Ndahiro says they have heard of reports of husbands involved in the conflict visiting their wives in Uganda.
It's true, we've picked information that they are husbands, not that they are armed, but they just sneak in through Polar's borders to check on their families. And of course, the communities keep this information with them. So by the time we get to pick this information, you cannot easily get these people. So what we are doing is to, of course, increase security vigilance.
The report is urging the Ugandan government, UNHCR and the international community to increase funding for refugees in Uganda in an effort to build harmony and peace among the different communities. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Chinese investment in Nigeria's oil and gas industry has reached $16 billion, according to Nigeria's state-run oil company. While Nigeria's oil industry welcomes China's interest, industry and political analysts worry about a lack of transparency in the sector and slow development of the country's renewable energy market. Chika Odua reports from Enugu.
When a top official from China's third largest national oil company paid a visit to Abuja, Nigeria this month, he was recommended by a top official of Nigeria's state-run oil company to increase investment in Nigeria's petroleum industry. Mele Kyari, the group managing director of the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, or NNPC, thanked the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, or CNOOC, for its continued support of Nigeria's oil and gas sector. Chinese investments in the sector have reached $16 billion. Kyari added that Nigeria needs partners like China. The two countries need each other to reach their oil production targets. Africa's largest oil-producing nation pumps 2 million barrels a day and has a goal of producing 3 million barrels a day by 2023. China's domestic oil production has been on a steady decline due to natural depletion and other geological challenges. So experts predict that up to 80% of China's crude oil supply will be imported by 2030. In comes Nigeria. CNOOC started business in Nigeria in 2005 and is currently the largest Chinese entity investor in Nigeria. With a focus on overseas investment, it's also China's largest offshore oil and natural gas developer. The company's executive vice president, Liu Yanji, said during the meeting that Nigeria is one of the company's largest investment destinations. He also said that CNOOC is producing 800,000 barrels per day, but it wants to reach 1.2 million. G hopes Nigeria can help with that, but there's skepticism. Nigeria has had a hard time reaching its production targets. There's sporadic militancy in the oil-producing region, as young people often take violent action to demand more access to the country's oil wealth. There's theft happening right at the pipelines. Fires often burn at rusted pipes, and oil operations in Nigeria get disrupted several times a year. Also, there's a serious lack of transparency. The NNPC has a long history of scandals with ongoing accusations of corruption. Crude oil is Nigeria's most lucrative export, and the NNPC has not been able to account for billions of dollars in revenue. That's why President Muhammadu Buhari has not appointed anyone as the oil minister. He handles that highly sought-after portfolio himself in his second term as president, just as he did in his first. Corruption is also why some Nigerians aren't applauding China for pouring money into Nigeria's murky oil industry. A host on Nigeria's popular Wazobia TV network, Uvbi Ehigiamosue, put it this way.
They're not going to actually monitor your spending, you understand, but they will just give you the money. If this is how it is, we know how all those things have been now.
She says the Chinese oil company will not monitor how Nigeria will use $16 billion in investments. And we know how it goes in Nigeria, she says. Some say it's high time Nigeria moves away from its dependence on oil. Revenue from the oil industry accounts for almost 75% of the federal budget, according to the Nigerian financial watchdog group Budget. Dr. Nwoke Okala, an energy specialist at the Center for Research and Development at the University of Nigeria in Nsukka, says Nigeria should follow the global trend of exploring renewable energy sources as oil becomes less attractive. But for now, Nigeria will continue to set its ambitions on oil. Nigerian business mogul and the richest man in Africa, Aliko Dangote, is building what will be Africa's largest oil refinery in the Nigerian commercial city of Lagos. With an expected annual refining capacity of 10.4 million tons of gasoline, the new refinery will double Nigeria's refining capacity and help in meeting the increasing domestic demand for fuel. The $9 billion mega complex is expected to be complete at the end of 2020 and could take Nigeria from a fuel importer to a fuel exporter. Chika Odua for VOA News in Enugu.
A fossil found in Ethiopia is letting scientists look millions of years into our evolutionary history. The journal Nature reports that the fossil shows the face of a possible ancestor for a human and is the oldest known fossil of an Australopithecus grouping, which preceded Homo sapiens, modern day humans. The fossilized skull is 3.8 million years old. What scientists call a remarkably complete fossil was discovered in February 2016 at the Waranso Mille. That is just 55 kilometers from where the famous Lucy was found in northeastern Ethiopia. Lucy is also an early ancestor of humans. The Lucy fossil was found in 1974 and dates back 3.2 million years. Sixteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Cases of rape are increasing at an alarming rate in Nigeria. According to UNICEF, one in four boys and one in 10 girls under the age of 18 are victims of sexual violence. Health experts say more children and young women are coming forward to talk about it as the public stigma in discussing rape slowly subsides. Three survivors who were willing to talk about their experiences are at the Salama Sexual Assault Referral Center in Gomana Awan General Hospital in the northern state of Kaduna. They insisted, however, on remaining anonymous.
Three survivors who preferred to remain anonymous told VOA about their experiences. They spoke in the Hausa language and Pidgin English. A three-year-old girl who was under the care of her grandmother was allegedly raped twice by a 44-year-old neighbor. The grandmother narrated what happened. She says she was reluctant to report it to the police because she believed she would not get justice, and being a poor widow, no one would believe her. It was on a second attempt that she ran to the Salama Center and received help. The second survivor, in her late 30s, says, she was kidnapped in her home while sleeping with her husband and child. She says her doctors made her walk through the night in thick forests. Later, the three of them took turns raping her every morning and evening until ransom was paid and they freed her. A 10-year-old girl who is the third survivor was reportedly raped by a 29-year-old man who lives in her neighborhood. She says she was lured to a corner by the perpetrator in the pretense that he wanted her to run an errand. The man stuffed her hijab in her mouth and raped her outside their compound. Juliana Joseph is the manager of the Salama Sexual Assault Referral Center. She says 90% of the victims are being sexually abused by people they know.
We've had grandparents raping their biological granddaughters. We've had fathers raping their biological daughters. We've had uncles raping their nieces and their nephews. We have trusted neighbors. You are going out and you entrust your children in the care of your neighbor, and by the time you are back, it is a different story.
A good number of the perpetrators of rape move about freely due to poor investigations. Barrister Zainab Aminu Garuba, chairperson of the International Federation of Women Lawyers, FIDA, in Kaduna, says rape has become an epidemic in the Northwest.
Rape is not just a phenomenon that is only known to be happening to only the women folk. It's happening to men too. Underage boys being defiled, several cases being reported to us. It is very worrisome, it is an epidemic, and I pray and hope that the government will see it as such and will do something very, very fast.
Yakubu Sabo, the police public relations officer in Kaduna State Command, said so many rape cases involving children go uninvestigated because parents want to protect their children from stigmatization.
Some families kill the evidence by sticking to that belief system that don't expose our child to the public that she had been raped, because at later stage she may not get a suitor to marry, or because of stigma will be attached to her. So this kind of perception or belief dampen the spirit for families to seek redress when their child is involved in cases of rape.
Sabo advised parents to be watchful in their neighborhood and be mindful of who they leave their children with. The Nigerian Criminal Code recommends life imprisonment for rape convicts and 14 years imprisonment for attempted rape. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
More than 800 Namibian refugees in Botswana have vowed to stay put despite a court ruling saying they must return to their country 20 years after fleeing following a secessionist uprising. The Botswana government has given the refugees until the end of August to leave the country, but they maintain they will not return over fears of persecution. From Habrone, Botswana, Mukandisi Dube has more.
Felix Kalula and hundreds of other Namibian refugees fled to Botswana in 1999 after violent clashes with Namibian government forces broke out over the disputed Caprivi Strip, which wanted to secede from the rest of the country. The Namibian and Botswana governments say it is now safe for the refugees to return home, and the migrants have until 31 August to leave. But Kalula says the issues that made them flee the Caprivi Strip have not been resolved.
Some of our colleagues are still in prison since 1999, and many of them died there in prison.
He says they've been asking for dialogue with the Namibian government, but the opportunity has not been afforded. Kalula was a member of the secessionist party, the United Democratic Party, which remains banned in Namibia, as the Caprivi residents were willing to use force to gain independence from Namibia. He says they are not prepared to return, and instead, the Botswana government will have to forcibly remove them.
We have informed the government of Botswana that we are not going to surrender through voluntary repatriation to return back to Caprivi or Namibia, as they call it, but we'll rather be deported.
Another Namibian refugee, John Shando, says the situation back home remains unsafe.
We live in fear now that once we are repatriated back home, we shall be killed because of our political beliefs.
He says there should be a referendum to resolve the Caprivi Strip dispute, and he urged the international community to intervene. Annette Toyano has been living at the Dukwi refugee camp in Botswana since 1998, and like her fellow countrymen and women, dreads going back home.
Now we are saying, if it's to die, we are going to die. We are not going to opt a repatriation to go back home, because at home is not safe.
Rights group Amnesty International has urged the Botswana government not to repatriate the refugees and instead is calling for dialogue. Botswana's President Mokgweetsi Masisi recently told his Namibian counterpart Hage Geingob that Habrone revoked refugee status as it deemed it fit for their return. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Habrone.
In Malawi, a report by the Office of the Public Protector or Ombudsman has shown that poor conditions in public hospitals are resulting in many expectant mothers having their uterus removed during childbirth. The report faulted the Ministry of Health for failing to provide sufficient staff for obstetrics and gynecology departments. But health authorities say efforts are being made to address the matter. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The report Wounds of the Womb, released last week, says more than 100 expectant mothers received care in the country's referral hospitals and had their uteruses removed during a six-month period last year. Martha Chizuma is the country's ombudsman.
Between January and July 2018, 160 uteruses were removed in the central hospitals only. We're talking of central hospitals only. There are some who we picked up, and because there are cases they could substantiate them, we will refer them to legal aid now for the actual claim for compensation.
This is Zodiac Broadcasting Station, ZBS.
The 37-page report follows a news article published by the privately owned weekly Malawi News in 2018 and later a documentary aired by the local radio station Zodiac Radio, in which women who had their uteruses removed at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital recounted their ordeal. She says, "When I arrived here, I was told to go for cesarean operation because nurses said baby inside my womb had difficulties breathing. But a day after delivery, I was referred to another operation where they removed my uterus because they said it had gone bad." Other women expressed similar experiences. She says, "I came here on the 14th and the baby was born on the 15th through an operation. But when I returned home, I came back because I was feeling dizzy. So here they told me that my uterus is full of pus and they had to remove it." The Public Protector report says that is largely because of government's failure to provide sufficient staff to cater for the needs of obstetrics and gynecology departments in all health facilities, resulting in compromised quality service delivery in the country.
Most of the times they find themselves in a situation where they are simply attending to emergency, all right? So you can go to the hospital, as I said. You're okay. You are just waiting for the delivery. But until you become an emergency yourself, that's when you get assistance.
The report recommends health workers who are negligent in their work face disciplinary action, a view that health rights campaigners support. George Jobe is the executive director for Malawi Health Equity Network.
Our expectation is that those in authority will act on the report. Our punishments should be done. But not only that, it should be timely, because justice delayed is almost justice denied.
Andrew Rikaka is Director of Quality Management of Digital Health for the Malawi Ministry of Health. He says the report's findings are of great concern to the government, but he adds disciplinary action does not happen overnight.
When we are talking about discipline in the health sector, it has to be noted that there are so many agencies that are responsible for discipline, and discipline is taken also on fairness principles. If it's something to do with a normal disciplinary issue, we have authorities at any level of health care that take up and address those disciplinary issues.
The country's medical regulatory body, the Medical Council of Malawi, says it has so far confirmed 20 cases of women who had their uteruses removed and has warned it will bar all medical workers implicated in the malpractice. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Controversy over refugee and immigration policies in the Trump administration continues unabated. On this encore edition of Press Conference USA, host Carol Castiel and Min Dao, editor in VOA's Vietnamese service, talk with Oan No Usadi, who fled South Vietnam and arrived in the United States as a refugee. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, education has the power to transform the lives of people worldwide, especially in Africa. But often, educational practices are outdated. Rethinking education on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Africa.